As soldiers wage war in Sudan, many civilians are fleeing. Even those who stay are helping others leave.
We're escaping and they can't escape, or they don't want to escape, but they want to make sure that our passage out of Khartoum starts off in a positive way.
Also today in Russia, any novel that mentions LGBTQ issues is banned. Some pinpoint the trigger for the new law, a bestseller about two gay men.
There were literally like no sex scenes in the book. The things that they hated, you can find them in any other like classical novel.
And the sprawling porch plants of Houston, Texas, and the immigrant gardeners who tend the flowers.
No matter where you are, humans have this fundamental need to be around nature. And no matter how small a space you have, it really connects you to something bigger.
I'm Marco Werman. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for making it here today. A shaky ceasefire is in place in Sudan after more than a week of deadly fighting between the military and a rival militia. Civilians are faced with a difficult choice: hunker down or try to escape. Tigrid Abdin lives about 4 miles from the center of Khartoum.
We actually have a discussion in the morning and every night. Do we stay or do we go?
For now, her family is staying. If they have power and water, she says that's enough for them to remain in the capital city. The quality of her phone line is a sign of the infrastructure breakdown people are dealing with in Khartoum. Abdin says they're running on fumes, literally.
Right now, with the ports closed, whatever fuel that is in Sudan, that is the fuel that exists for all the people of Sudan.
She says the bank apps to make payments, as well as ATMs, have stopped working. Then there's rapid inflation, prices shooting up in a matter of days.
With the prices doubling, tripling from $20 to $300.
Combine all of this with the military shelling, and many are simply choosing to get out of Khartoum. People like Dalia Abdelmonaim, she and her family have fled to the north, to the coastal city of Port Sudan.
We took the safest and the longest route, basically, to get to Port Sudan. We had kids and elderly people with us, so we didn't want to take the risk of bumping into the RSF troops.
Yeah, the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces.
Yes. So we opted for this route. Our bus driver was actually very knowledgeable, and he advised us that this was the safest way to get to Port Sudan, which is what we did. And I'm thankful for him for that, because his advice was priceless. I mean, he was always on his phone, getting information, telling him, avoid this area, go to that area. So he went above and beyond his job as a coach driver.
You said this was the safest route that you took, 26 hours. I mean, a lot of the fighting has been centered on Khartoum. Did you encounter less fighting as you got further from the city, or were there skirmishes along the way or on the horizon? What did you see?
Well, one of the possible routes, there were skirmishes, so we opted for another route. We only encountered army convoys and army checkpoints. But then again, there isn't that much fighting outside of Khartoum. It's mainly centered in Khartoum. We were actually, you know, kind of worried, will we be able to arrive safely? But we were able to get to this city called Kassala, and we found a guest house, and we stayed there for like 5 hours. They very kindly put us up for 5 hours. The bus was nearly 50 passengers, and they let us all stay in the guest house for free.
Amazing.
Until dawn, and then we were on our way to Port Sudan.
Well, that kind of hospitality, I mean, you posted photos of the trek, and in one image, you're driving through a village, and locals are coming toward your vehicle with big jugs. What was in those jugs?
Hibiscus juice and cold water. And they were just giving it to all the travelers leaving Khartoum. And these people, I mean, these villages are really poor. And they don't even live near the highway. They would have to, like, walk to get to where the buses would pass by. And they were just standing there with their drinks and just waving us down to stop and have a sip of some sweet juice or cold water and then be off on our way. And they just wish us luck and wish us safety. And there's a saying in Arabic, it says, Bissalama, may you arrive in peace. And that's what they were wishing us. And it just broke my heart, because they really have nothing, but they offered us so much. And it touched me, because end of the day, we're all one, we're all Sudanese, and we're escaping, and they can't escape, or they don't want to escape, but they want to make sure that our passage out of Khartoum starts off in a positive way.
Incredible.
It's one of those memories that I will always have.
As you said in one of your social media posts, you said it was a humbling experience.
Yeah, it's moments like this that make you understand the humanity of people. And most of us are caught up in situations that are beyond our own control. And we have nothing to do with it, but we all suffer because of it. But they try to make it better for us.
Many of your friends and relatives, Dalia, have also fled Khartoum. Many headed to the border of Egypt. What are they telling you about the situation on the border there?
I've been talking to relatives who've been stuck at the border for nearly 2 days, and they're at their wits' end. The border at Egypt is a horror story. I think the sheer number of people and the fact that the border is not usually a popular choice for people to cross over, so I think it's undermanned. And Egypt has set a lot of rules, like if you're a male under the age of 50, you cannot come in without a visa. However, because once fighting broke out in Khartoum, the embassy was shut. So there's no access to, you know, to get a visa to enter Egypt. So it's just a mess. But I also saw someone post that the Egyptian Red Crescent was really working overtime to try and, you know, help the people who were stuck at the border, providing them with water, with food, as much as they could. People are going in their own private cars. People are going in like small mini buses or mini vans at this very small office, I think manned by 2 to 3 agents. And it's just, I'm not surprised at the chaos that's going on over there. I'm not surprised at all.
And so what is life like in Port Sudan today?
It's like we've stepped back into how Khartoum was before the clashes erupted. Port Sudan was one of the first cities that the army gained control over from the first day because it's a port and it's the main port for Sudan. So they had to ensure that the passage in terms of shipping and so on was open. So it's very calming. And I think after what we've been through, especially with the younger ones, the children, it's been a good stopover because they've calmed down. They're less tense. They're less anxious, you know, because we were living literally under bombardment for every day, like nonstop. It would start from like 2 to 3 in the morning until maybe 6 in the evening. It was just nonstop, you know, hearing rockets going off, and it was too much. But at the same time, in the back of our minds, we're all thinking, okay, what's the next step? What other options do we have? Because we can't stay here forever. We need to plan for the next 3 to 6 months at least, because we don't think we'll be able to go back to Khartoum anytime sooner. I mean, I'd love to go back tomorrow if I could. If I could go back right now, if I could, but I can't.
Last question, Dalia. As you know, fighting seems to have calmed slightly in some places in Sudan. Do you hold out any hope for the most recent efforts at the ceasefire?
Well, I didn't until I spoke to a contact of mine, and he told me, trust me, behind closed doors, the diplomatic efforts, they're really working overtime. He's like, the pressure on these two generals is immense, and it's coming from all corners. So that's given me hope that maybe, just maybe, common sense will prevail. I hope, I have hope. I will always have hope, and that's all we can hold on to at this moment in time.
Dalia, thanks very much for being with us. Stay safe.
Thank you, Marco.
Dalia Abdel Monaim lived in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, until just a few days ago. Now she and her family have evacuated to the north and are in Port Sudan, awaiting an end to the fighting between rival generals that has raged for more than a week. Today is World Malaria Day, an important reminder that malaria, one of the leading causes of death in the world, kills more than 600,000 people each year globally. Many are children. There's also more hope now to rid the planet of the disease than ever before. Kenya, for example, is piloting a malaria vaccine for children. So far, the results are encouraging. The world's Halima Gikandi brings us more from Western Kenya.
Migori County in western Kenya is full of lush trees and lies close to Lake Victoria. Those combination of factors makes malaria a big problem here, says Florence Ingere. She's the malaria program coordinator for the county.
Migori, obviously, we are in hot and cold weather, which is a conducive environment for mosquito breeding. The proximity to the lake is a contributing factor to high burden of malaria.
Malaria is a constant worry here, especially for parents. The new malaria vaccine for children is bringing some relief. It's the first to be approved by the World Health Organization, which is supporting a pilot in Kenya and 2 other countries.
We have a target of the children that we really need to give the vaccine, which are children below 2 years old.
because that group is most at risk of dying from malaria. I visit a hospital in Owendo, one of the first places in Migori to receive the vaccine. Melissa Otiang is a nurse here. She reminds me why malaria is so dangerous for children.
Because their immunity is still low. So when they get affected with malaria, they get the severe forms. These children, they can have organ failure, like kidney failure.
She tells me before this vaccine, out of 10 children who got malaria here, around 5 or 6 might die. But that's changing at this hospital.
Since the introduction of this vaccine, we can say that the death rates has reduced. In 10 children, maybe 1 or none dies from malaria infection.
She adds, immunized children who do get malaria get a milder form that can be treated at home. This is why Ochiang and other health workers are encouraging parents with children under 2 years old to get their kids vaccinated.
I can say that the response and the uptake has been good. So far, we've not met any resistance or any complaint towards the vaccine.
She said even people from other areas are bringing their children here to get this malaria vaccine, which comes in 4 doses.
We give the first antigen at 6 months, at 7 months, and at 9 months.
The fourth and final dose comes at 24 months, or 2 years old. That big gap between doses is causing some issues, she says.
These mothers take a long time before they come back to the clinic at 24 months. So some of them tend to forget. That is one of the main challenges that we've gotten.
This has been a challenge across the board, says Emily Otieno. She coordinates immunization services in Migori. She tells me the county has surpassed its vaccination targets for the first doses, but that number dwindles by the time you get to dose 4, when the child is fully protected. She tells me one way they've been addressing that is through CHVs, or community health volunteers.
Our CHVs can be ignited to do household visitations. So they keep on now reminding and asking, as your child, any child below 2 years, as the child began the schedule? And if yes, are you continuing, go to the facility.
One of those community health workers is Stephen Odhiambo Otieno. He tells me there are still a lot of people who don't know about this malaria vaccine yet. So part of his job is to spread the word.
For malaria vaccine, it is very easy because most of the community members, they take it positively as compared to COVID-19, where we had a lot of myths and misconceptions.
One of the people in his community is mother of two, Christian Achieng Okoth. Her 11-month-old daughter is due to receive her second dose of the vaccine this week. I ask Okoth why she decided to give her daughter the vaccine.
I've experienced it. I've suffered from malaria. My first son has suffered from malaria. So when I heard from the radio about the vaccination, I was interested.
She tells me it was really scary seeing her son so sick.
Sometimes you just pity the kid, the way he's suffering. He's a playful boy. And so when he has malaria, he doesn't play, he cries a lot, he doesn't eat, vomits.
Okoth says she is relieved that she can give her daughter some protection in her early years. Because Okoth and her older son are not vaccinated, she says she is still taking other preventative measures, like sleeping under a mosquito net. Health experts say combining different malaria interventions with the vaccine will provide the best protection to children. For The World, I'm Halima Gikondi, Migori, Kenya.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Tomorrow, Israel marks 75 years since the founding of the modern-day Jewish state. That was in 1948. Today, Israelis observe Memorial Day. Typically, it's a moment of national unity to remember the military dead and people who lost their lives in terrorist attacks. But the political atmosphere in Israel right now is deeply divided. The World's Matthew Bell is in the studio to talk us through what's happening. Matthew, describe what Memorial Day is all about. How does it usually go?
It's quite moving, to be honest. We don't really have anything like it here in the U.S. So on this day, pretty much wherever you are in the country, at 11 a.m., there's this 2-minute-long siren that sounds. Once I was on the highway, actually, going along at like 65 miles an hour, and suddenly cars start pulling over. People get out of their cars. I hear the siren and realize that, I mean, literally everything comes to a stop, and people stood there in silence while the sirens wailed. There are also official Memorial Day ceremonies. These are often held at cemeteries. Of course, very solemn events. But today, given the deep political divide that's playing out in Israel, there were real concerns about tensions at these ceremonies.
Yeah, I mean, one of the headlines in the newspaper Haaretz reads, Israel's tensest Memorial Day. So what exactly happened today?
So ahead of this holiday, there was controversy brewing already, and that's because family members of some fallen soldiers and victims of terrorist attacks had publicly called for Israeli politicians to stay away from these Memorial Day events. They said they didn't want to hear political speeches. Remember, in Israel, there have been months of massive protests against the government's plan to reform the judicial system there. Supporters of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his right-wing government say that these reforms are needed. But the protesters, and they have come from across the political spectrum, they say the government's plans would threaten Israel's democratic system by undermining the Supreme Court. So today, when the far-right cabinet member Itamar Ben-Gavir, for example, went to make a speech at a cemetery in the city of Be'er Sheva today, there was an angry response from some people there. There was another scene today, Marco, in Jerusalem when Netanyahu spoke at a Memorial Day ceremony. A man whose sister died in a terrorist attack carried out a silent protest of his own. He held up an Israeli flag with words written on it, accusing the prime minister of undoing Israel as a Jewish and democratic state.
Matthew, you mentioned the months of protests with people expressing an unprecedented feeling that their country is teetering on the brink. Set the backdrop for this anniversary. What is the national mood in Israel?
Politics in Israel has always been, you know, they say a contact sport, very intense. But this really does, I think, to a lot of Israelis feel like something fundamentally different. So this is a fight over what to do about the judicial system. People tell me across left, right, and center politically that there is support for doing some sort of reform about the way the courts would work and the sort of system of checks and balances there. But there's a sense among the people who are worried about this that it's not just a specific issue about judicial reform, that it really would fundamentally change the way the government works and the checks and balance system. I mean, just to characterize how worried a lot of Israelis are, Marco. Here's a quote from President Isaac Herzog. He said, "I am convinced that there is no greater existential threat to our people than the one that comes from within, our own polarization and alienation from one another." That's something he said on the eve of the 75th anniversary of the country.
Yeah. So what does come next for the Israeli government's controversial plans on reforming the judiciary?
This is definitely not over. Prime Minister Netanyahu has not said that he's going to back away from it. A few weeks ago, he sort of hit the pause button on this process, and the speculation was that he was really hoping that the protest movement would sort of lose steam. But that definitely did not happen. These weekly protests have continued. They've been really big. They're expected to keep going in the coming weeks. But another thing that's expected, counter-protests, people who support judicial reform and this far-right government, and there are real concerns about what could happen in the streets with potential clashes between opposing protest groups.
The World's Matthew Bell, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
TikTok videos can go viral fast with positive and negative reactions. Recent videos from the official Paralympics TikTok account are getting a wide range of responses. They show Paralympic athletes falling and making other fumbles during competitions. The World's Bianca Hillier has our story.
One of the videos getting the most attention features Turkish para table tennis player Abdullah Öztürk.
Can't go over it, we can't go under it.
While celebrating winning gold at the Tokyo Paralympics, he accidentally falls out of his wheelchair and through a fence. Just as the TikTok sound goes,
"Oh no, we got to go through it."
It has 15 million views. Another video shows Australian single-leg cyclist Darren Hicks, who had his right leg amputated after a crash. The TikTok shows him pedaling toward the finish line of a para-cycling event with this sound. It has 40 million views and nearly 5 million likes. Amputee footballer Sean Jackson watched from his home in England.
Straight away, it was just sort of disappointment. You know, they use the platform to mock incredible athletes and sort of use videos of athletes failing, in my opinion, to try and get some likes and follows.
Jackson works with children with disabilities and worries the online videos will translate into offline bullying.
TikTok's a platform that a lot of kids have, and if kids are seeing that's how disability athletes are being sort of treated and how they come across, yeah, I think it's only going to be negative.
He's also nervous about how the videos will impact kids with disabilities who are thinking about joining a sports team.
You know, if someone's living with a disability and they see that, I can imagine it would discourage them to get involved.
The fact that these videos are coming from the official Paralympics account has shocked a lot of people. Many are calling the videos mean and lacking empathy. But Jack Hunter Spivey had a different reaction. He's a para table tennis player and two-time Paralympian from Great Britain.
I thought they were great. It was a new way of showcasing Paralympic sport.
Hunter Spivey is among another large group who think the videos are funny and help humanize Paralympians. That includes some of the athletes featured in them, who say they are not offended by the content. Hunter Spivey says he would even like to be featured on the page himself to bring attention to his sport.
I think as Paralympians, we're always seen as inspirational and fighting adversity, and which we are. Don't get me wrong, we all have amazing stories, but we can also make fun of ourselves as well. And disability isn't such a fragile thing that we have to tread carefully around all the time.
That's one of the main reasons why Richard Fox, the person who runs the Paralympics TikTok account, posts these kinds of videos. Fox, a Paralympian himself, explained in an interview with Adweek.
I'm not very happy with inspiration porn, and so I wanted to showcase people with disabilities doing sport, but in a different way to how it's been done previously.
Sean Jackson says, as an amputee, he can see the funny side of the videos. But both he and Hunter Spivey say they wish the account had a bit more range.
Maybe the Paralympics account could post a few more success videos of people winning medals and such and such.
Athletes will be able to show off their talents next summer when the Paralympics kick off in Paris at the 2024 Games. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're with The World. Ghost towns in Myanmar, most of the country's Rohingya people have fled. Their home now, the sprawling camps of Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh. More than a million people packed into the world's largest refugee settlement.
So you have a generation who have very little education and very little hope.
The stories of life and glimmers of hope for refugees in Cox's Bazar, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In the U.S., efforts to ban books in schools and libraries nearly doubled last year. The works of novelists like Toni Morrison and Margaret Atwood were frequent targets, as well as books about LGBTQ topics. In Russia, all-out book bans are increasingly happening. The Kremlin recently passed a new law that bans any mention of LGBTQ issues in novels. As Levi Bridges reports, it's part of a larger crackdown there on writers generally.
The Russian novel Summer in a Pioneer Tie opens in an old, rundown summer camp in eastern Ukraine. The protagonist, a young man, recalls a summer he spent there as a teenager when he fell in love with a camp counselor. What starts as a summer camp romance between two teenage boys turns into a sprawling novel when the lovers improbably meet as adults. The two women who wrote the book originally posted it for free on a fan fiction website, and that might have been the end of it. But one of the authors, Yelena Malisova, says the book started going viral on Twitter and TikTok in 2018. Superfans even posted video homages on YouTube, like this one, where scenes from the Disney film The Lion King are dubbed over with voices impersonating characters from the novel. The book was eventually acquired by an actual publisher and became a bestseller. Katerina Silvanova, the book's co-author, says the novel was a litmus test for Russia. She says after the novel came out, publishers started offering contracts to other Russian authors who write books with queer themes. But bookstores had to pull them off the shelves this year to comply with Russia's new anti-LGBTQ law, passed in December.
Even from such sites, they remove mention наших книжек, удаляют эти страницы, удаляют какие-то интервью.
Silvanova says even online book forums started deleting basic information about their novel, like plot summaries and reviews. The two women also started receiving some really scary threats online. So last year, they fled the country for safety.
Эти люди, которые травлю развязывали, мне кажется, сделали все возможное.
I feel like the people who threatened us did everything possible to ensure I'd be afraid to stay in Russia, says Melisova, the book's other author. They deprived me of my country and separated me from my family, she says. Their publisher quickly became the target of the government's first investigation into possible violations of the new law. Satanik Anastasian, the former editor-in-chief of the publishing house, says the way Russian lawmakers reacted to the novel, Summer in a Pioneer Tie, was way overblown, because it's just a fairly innocent novel about first love.
There were literally, like, no sex scenes in the book. The things that they hated, you can find them in any other, like, classical novel. Lolita as a classical Russian literature. It should be even more appalling for them, but that obviously meant that they just don't read books.
To what extent do you think that the book Summer in a Pioneer Tie was the reason they passed this new law?
Yeah, this book is 100% the reason for adopting this new law, because the book became the most read fiction book in Russia in 2022.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has insinuated LGBTQ rights are connected to Satanism. Irina Roldugina, a historian of queer history, says Putin tells Russians that, historically, gay people never had a place in Russia. But she says that's not true, because the Bolsheviks actually abolished an anti-gay law from Tsarist times.
So technically, Russia was the first major country to decriminalize homosexuality.
But starting under Stalin, gay men were persecuted by the state. Rodolgina says that history obscures a fundamental part of the Russian character.
Russians are not inherently homophobic people. Russian people just need information, and they do not have information on LGBTQ plus issues, because this kind of information is actually banned, right? So the information just cannot be spread.
Russia's new anti-LGBTQ law is part of a regional trend of governments repressing writers. Hanna Komar is a poet and activist from nearby Belarus. She says Belarus's authoritarian government has closed writers' organizations and jailed dozens of authors to stop dissent.
You know what tyranny is? It's not about suppressing you physically. It's about suppressing your mind. So they don't want any free thinking people who think critically. And that's what literature helps you do, right? Think critically.
But in Russia, even banned books have still had a huge impact on readers.
Наши читатели многие, которые гетеросексуальной ориентации, например.
Елена Малисова, one of the authors of Summer in a Pioneer Tie, says readers outside of the LGBTQ plus community wrote her saying the novel widened their perspectives and changed their opinions. And that's exactly what a good book is supposed to do. For The World, I'm Levi Bridges.
Right now, weapons manufacturers are awash in money, historically so. Across the globe, military spending reached record highs last year. Researchers from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute crunched the numbers. Nan Tien is a senior researcher at the institute. So for decades, Nan, the U.S. has spent the most on military spending. Who's next? And is that still the case with the U.S.?
Yes, so the U.S. has been the number one spender ever since we've started to record military spending data. And in second place, China has really taken off and increased its spending over the last 30 years, really catching up to the U.S. from about 1 in 30, the ratio, to now only 1 in 2.5.
And where did you see the biggest percentage increases in spending?
Some of the biggest percentage increases in spending, of course, are directly related to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Ukraine's spending actually increased by 640% in 2022.
Wow.
The largest increase ever recorded within our database. And it just is a sheer reflection of the huge financial cost that Ukraine has suffered since Russia's invasion.
640% for Ukraine spending on defense. Is that typical for a country at war?
Sometimes you see these unique cases. You know, the next highest increase was Ethiopia with its war in the Tigray region. Its spending increased by 88%.
Hmm. Were there spending increases in countries not actively involved in a conflict?
Looking at the broader Central and Western Europe, what we really saw was that countries that were relatively close geographically to Ukraine increased their spending by quite a bit. We saw Finland increase by 36%, Lithuania 27%, Poland 11%, Sweden 12%. And again, this really reflects the threat perception that these countries are seeing now, a genuine threat perception of Russia.
I mean, threat perception clearly is a huge driver, but what else is driving all this spending?
A lot of the largest spenders in the world, I mean, I mentioned USA, China, India, they are going through a large and very expensive military modernization programs. In the case of course, the US, it wants to maintain its military superiority as the biggest military and the military with the largest geographical reach.
The idea of mutually assured destruction is one doctrine of military strategy. Basically, more nuclear weapons keep us safer because no country would be so crazy to use them because it would result in their own destruction. But what about with lower grade weapons? Do we know if a world increasingly armed to the teeth is really any safer, or do more weapons simply lead to more war, death, and destruction?
It increases the likelihood that there could be a miscommunication, a miscalculation in military capabilities and actions, and that could lead to the use of some of these weapons.
Is there anything to suggest that the more spending there is on defense, the more likely conflicts are going to happen?
Right now, countries are looking through military spending as a way for security, security through deterrence. But of course, in the case, if we look at South Asia or East Asia, right now, there's a brewing tension going on between China, Japan, Taiwan, and of course, the US. And currently, what we're seeing is a decrease in communication and negotiations between these, let's say, four countries, and an increase in armaments.
Right.
And so indeed, that the trend is going towards, of course, more weapons, less dialogue.
Yeah. So, Nan, I mean, spending is so intense that weapon manufacturers can barely keep up. Do you have any insight into whether this trend is sustainable?
So we expect that global military spending will continue to increase in the coming years because the war in Ukraine is nowhere nearing an end. Secondly, the geopolitical rivalries between China, India, Japan, US will continue. Companies essentially are getting more and more orders from countries to buy these weapons. And of course, these companies are building these weapons. The companies have already mentioned that it has been struggling to kind of fulfill the demand. But I think this backlog will continue for years to come as there's just essentially too much demand right now, unfortunately.
Nan Tien is a senior researcher at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. He was one of the researchers who examined worldwide military spending in 2022. Nan Tien, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
The sprawling apartment blocks of the Gulfton neighborhood of Houston, Texas. These are homes to many immigrant families from a lot of different countries. If you walk through the area, you might see the flag of Afghanistan or images of the Virgin of Guadalupe, the patron saint of Mexico. You will also no doubt spot some robust porch gardens. Houston Chronicle reporter Elizabeth Troval has that story.
On her second floor balcony, Juana Guerrero shows me a large potted rosemary plant. It's one of many herbs, peppers, and other porch plants she cares for. Mint, lemongrass, aloe vera. When I ask if she has a favorite, she says,
No, todas me gustan.
She likes all of them, she says. Her plants are something special in her life.
No, porque todas mis plantas es algo especial en mi vida.
They're like my grandchildren, says the 69-year-old from Central Mexico. She loves them all.
Son como mi nieta. Quiero todas mis plantas, las quiero mucho.
She learned to garden from her mom and grandma at the ranch where she grew up. Her grandmother would tell her every morning to make tea from various herbs and plants.
Todas las mañanas me decía un tecito que de ruda, que te de limón.
Tea from rue, lemon, cinnamon, mint. Guerrero is proud of her concrete porch full of greenery, which she admits exceeds the apartment complex's poorly enforced three-plant limit. They're part of her daily routine. First thing every morning, she wakes up and talks to them. What did you all do? How was your night? She asks. Then gives them a pep talk when they're not doing well. If I love you, why are you sad? She says. Come on. Whether you talk to them or not, plants can make life all the more vibrant, according to Jaime Gonzalez. He's a director at Houston's Nature Conservancy.
So I think that a full life has lots of opportunities to connect with nature.
He says not only can porch plant gardening beautify a home and your community, it also benefits the gardener.
It can elevate your mood, decrease symptoms of things like depression. It can actually decrease your chances of getting dementia, believe it or not. And it also just gives you lots of physical exercise, which is always good for your body, too.
He says back in college, he remembers growing porch plants in his own patio. It brought a little nature into his apartment complex, he says, like pollinators. It also made him think about life itself.
No matter where you are, humans have this fundamental need to be around nature. And no matter how small a space you have, you can find either houseplants or plants to have on your porches or things like that. And it really connects you to something bigger.
For Felicita Gomez, a relatively new resident in Gulfton, it was crucial that she found a building that would allow her to bring her plants she'd been growing for years. She couldn't think of leaving them behind. She gives a tour of her ground floor garden, where she admits her roses are struggling. Then she walks over to the grassy area past her garden. She points to a green stem with small white flowers. It's a yucca flower, she says. That's the national flower of El Salvador, where she's from. She says you can wash the flowers, dice them up, and saute them with eggs. It's a yummy snack, she says. And you can find this beautiful plant all over Houston. Most people here just don't know you can eat it, too. Where Gomez is from, near the coast of El Salvador, her family depended on their plants when money was tight, which was often. She says sometimes when they were hungry and there wasn't anything to eat, they would knock down guavas from one of the trees. Even though the 53-year-old didn't have much growing up, the plants her mom cared for at their home kept their bellies full. For The World, I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
President Biden announced that he is running for re-election today. Should he get a second term, he will be 86 years old when he leaves office. We wanted to put that in a global perspective. There are plenty of world leaders still serving well into their 80s. That was Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas being interviewed on Al Arabiya this year, still sharp at age 87.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, buongiorno.
And that was Pope Francis this past Sunday at 86. He's a rock star. Another religious figure there, Iran Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, delivered this speech, critical of the United States, last October, still a figure to be reckoned with at 84. Then there's Queen Margrethe II of Denmark, King Harald of Norway, Governor General Cornelius Smith of the Bahamas, the Emir of Kuwait, all of them active octogenarian rulers. Still, some other mature heads of state are struggling.
The world's oldest leader turned 90 on Monday. But some in Cameroon aren't celebrating President Paul Biya's milestone.
Social media has not been kind.
The man was at the US-Africa summit last month, and he had no idea where he was or why he was there.
Tough take. Thomas Pearls says lots of people can function well at an advanced age, even as heads of state. Pearls is a professor at Boston University School of Medicine and founder of the New England Centenarian Study.
For the head of state of Cameroon, if he's not doing well, I think it's really important to get a look at what his health habits are, what his various illnesses are.
Pearls says it's not how old you are, but how well you live.
Whether we smoke, drink, or if we're obese, if we're regularly exercising or not, our diet, if it's a healthy diet or not.
Good guidance for living and perhaps for leading a nation. In Bangladesh, Cox's Bazar is one of the largest refugee settlements in the world. We're talking more than 1 million people packed into sprawling makeshift camps. These are places where writer Kamil Ahmed has spent a lot of time. He's gotten to know dozens of refugees who live in Cox's Bazar for his new book, I Feel No Peace, Rohingya Fleeing Overseas in Rivers. It's Rohingya people telling their own story in their own words. I asked Kamil to take us back 6 years ago to a consequential turning point in the persecution of the Rohingya. And a warning, parts of our interview may not be appropriate for all listeners.
2017 was the year when, after decades of persecution, the Rohingya faced a military operation on a scale they had never been victim to before. In the name of military clearance operations, the Myanmar army carried out massacres, essentially, of villages throughout Rakhine State on the border of Bangladesh, which is where the Rohingya are concentrated. And these massacres involved mass killing, rape, and the burning down of their villages.
In all, how many Rohingya people did flee? And are there any Rohingya remaining in Myanmar?
There are about 700,000 are estimated to have fled. The numbers are not completely clear. An exact number kind of often varies depending on how they've been counted. But it's a significant number. And when you take in that there were up to 300,000 already living in Bangladesh, you are talking about the majority of the Rohingya. And so we don't know exactly how many are left, but it's generally considered that the majority of Rohingya now have been expelled from Myanmar.
Early in your book, Kamil, you introduced us to a woman you call Momtaz. At the time, she's in a village called Tulatoli. Tell us about Momtaz. What is her situation?
Momtaz is probably the woman whose story is the most tragic, the worst of anything I've ever heard, anyone I've ever interviewed. She was someone who lived in Tulatoli, this village in Rakhine State, was probably, as far as we know, the worst hit village by the Myanmar military during the 2017 massacres.
And when you say worst hit, you're talking the village was completely burned to the ground, many people killed?
Yes, so it was the village where the most people were killed. It seemed almost, it's also possibly the most clear-cut case of the operation, the attack being systematic. The villagers had considered leaving the village for safety, having heard and seen violence in their surrounding villages prior to that day, and been told they would be safe. But by the morning, the military had arrived. It had surrounded the village. It began shooting. And when people tried to escape, they couldn't because there was a river and they were completely circled in and kind of just completely vulnerable to the military, who killed the men, raped many of the women, killed many of the children, and set not just their homes on fire, it put people into a mass grave and set their bodies on fire.
Yeah, well, not surprisingly, today villages like Tulatoli are ghost towns. Some of the survivors of those massacres you described, like Momtaz, they managed to find friends and relatives after they fled to Bangladesh. Momtaz finally gets out of the hospital and manages to locate her younger sister Dildar. What kind of reunion do they have?
An extremely emotional one, because Momtaz actually thinks she's the only surviving member of her family. And she arrives in Bangladesh almost entirely alone, only with one of her children, Rozia, who's 7 years old, who's the only of her children who has survived. And she thought she'd lost everyone. And she thinks she's alone until she starts hearing about this other woman from Tulatoli who looks like her, but is somewhere else. And at first, she doesn't have the energy to go looking for her. But when it becomes clear that there is someone, there is something she needs to do, she goes looking and eventually finds Dilda in another camp. And I think for them, it's like someone coming back to life. They had fought each other dead.
Kamil, as you track the lives of Rohingya refugees in your book, at times it feels something of an indictment of the United Nations. What exactly is the UN's role in assisting the Rohingya?
Well, the UN, as it does in most humanitarian crises, will turn up and provide the basics. It will provide shelter, food, and that's what I think we all expect of them. But there is a long-term crisis as well. And it's not just a matter of feeding people and providing them shelter. It's where do they go next? It has not really performed its role of protecting the Rohingya. It's wanted to not upset the government and has tried to kind of accept it. Very restrictive policies, food rations being reduced, actual forced repatriations, violence and intimidation, closure of schools, restrictions on their movement. These are things you wouldn't expect the UN to allow. You expect them to push back against. There's a man called Nobby, who I speak to in the book, who's a very intelligent person who has worked really hard to educate himself and tries to help to teach others. But after 30 years of living in a Rohingya refugee camp, his home a couple of years ago burnt down in 30 minutes. And I think that really, for me, exemplified the failures of the international system.
Kamil, finally, just to return to the first character in your book, Momtaz. I mean, despite the trauma she's been through fleeing Myanmar, she finally finds a bit of peace in Cox's Bazar, right?
It's not a completely happy story. She gets remarried and the man leaves her soon afterwards. But she has a baby, and for someone who had lost all of her children bar one, there's some happiness I think she didn't expect. To have the experience of looking after a child again, I think it was really something she was so happy about, finally, once her son was born.
Well, like I said, a bit of peace. Kamil Ahmed is the author of I Feel No Peace, Rohingya Fleeing Overseas in Rivers. Thanks very much for sharing these stories. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
We end today's program to note the passing of Harry Belafonte at the age of 96. Singer, actor, activist.
Malaika, nakupenda malaika. Malaika, nakupenda.
Malaika, my angel. Belafonte recorded the song with South African singer Miriam Makeba back in 1965. Throughout his life, Belafonte was a staunch defender of civil rights. Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear more about Harry Belafonte's work to end apartheid in South Africa. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and thanks for listening.